Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, an investigation into the mental state of Donald Trump and the cognitive disconnection in the American public for electing morally sound leaders. My guest to share insights is Dr. John Gartner from Townsend, Maryland. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University Medical School, where he has taught for the past 28 years. He also is in private practice in Baltimore and Manhattan, where he specializes in borderline personality and bipolar disorders and depression. His work has been published in numerous peer-reviewed and professional journals, as well as in the Washington Post, Chicago Times, Baltimore Sun. And he was named by the American Library Association as one of the best books authors of 2008. He coined the term hypomanic to describe the synergy between mania and success that is familiar in many successful people. He graduated magna cum laude from Princeton University, a doctorate in clinical psychology from University of Massachusetts, and completed his postdoctoral training at New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center. More recently, he has been investigating the psychological state of Donald Trump and has spearheaded efforts to warn officials and the public about the president's severe personality disorders that could endanger the nation if he is not removed from office. He is a co-founder of a new organization, Duty to Warn, comprised of mental health professionals who feel the ethical responsibility to warn the public about the dangers posed by Trump's mental health state. Nice to have you with us today.
Very nice to be here. I just want to mention that I retired from Hopkins 2 years ago, and the only reason I bring that up is because I don't think they want to be associated with my point of view.
Oh, that's fine. Okay.
But thank you for having me. Okay.
All right. Well, what we're looking at today is we're looking at something that is being discussed more and more, but has not been discussed in previous administrations, and I wished it had been, because I do not see that we're making the type of choices in the people because we're so enamored or drawn to their personalities. And it's hard for people to distinguish and separate out what they feel about someone. Like, most people liked Barack Obama and most people liked Bill Clinton. But you have to look at their actions, not just their personalities, to see do they deserve to be in this most powerful position in the world. So I'd like to begin by discussing some general terms for mental disorders that others in the media have raised with respect to Trump's mental condition.
Yes.
And psychopathology and narcissism are perhaps the two most common.
Yes.
And given his propensity for wild exaggerations that don't match reality and the facts, he's been called delusional. Now, the current phrase now you and your colleagues are using to describe Trump is malignant narcissism. So before we go into the specifics of Trump, please provide the characteristics of this diagnosis. And are there any figures in history that you can look back upon as examples of this condition? And would you argue that this is a learned condition and behavior or something deeper, more intrinsically biological to the person's psyche? The form is yours.
Thank you. So just to go back to the history of the term, it was introduced originally by Eric Fromm, the founder of humanistic psychology. He himself fled the Nazis, and the diagnosis of malignant narcissism was his attempt to explain Hitler. He was very concerned with the psychology of evil, and this four-part diagnosis that I'm going to describe in more detail was developed, I think it's important to note, historically, to explain Hitler. It has four components. The first you mentioned is narcissism. The second is antisocial personality disorder. So these are people who lie, as we know Donald Trump does, who routinely violate and exploit the rights of others, and who show no remorse for the people they've harmed. So the antisocial component is very important. This is sort of the bad hombre criminal personality. So the narcissism is combined with this fundamental dishonesty and lack of concern for other people. The third component is paranoia or paranoid personality disorder. hence all of his wild and, you know, frankly, crazy conspiracy theories. And, you know, there's now been about 75, somebody put a list together of wild conspiracy theories that he's endorsed. We even forget about some of them. There's so many of them. We always focus on those recent ones, and we forget that he said, you know, Ted Cruz's father helped kill Kennedy, and that Barack Obama had the head of Hawaii Vital Records murdered to hide the truth about his birth certificate, that Antonin Scalia was murdered, and Hillary probably did it. So these are, you know, wild accusations, obviously, crazy accusations. And the other part of the paranoia is the demonization of minority groups or anyone who doesn't support him. So the press aren't just being unfair, they're scum, they're the enemy of the people. You know, Mexicans aren't just over-immigrating illegally, they're rapists, and they're, you know, kind of destroying the fabric of society. Islam is intrinsically evil. So there's a demonization. And the fourth component is sadism, actually taking pleasure in causing pain to other people. Donald Trump's been a bully since he was a kid, and he does a large number of his tweets are essentially cyberbullying, where he humiliates and denigrates other people over and over again in the most sarcastic terms and tries to publicly humiliate them. And when he said, you know, I'd like to punch that protester in the face, you know, the encouragement of violence at his rallies, there's a part of him that gets off on that, gets pleasure from it. When you combine these four characteristics, Eric Frome called this the quintessence of evil. And quite frankly, when we combine it with the fact that sometimes he really does seem disconnected from reality and is able to sort of drink his own Kool-Aid and actually believe these grandiose and persecutory ideas that are so easily disprovable and so clearly crazy, but if he actually believes them, then that's delusional. And I think it's not always just done for effect. I think he really does believe some of the paranoid and grandiose statements that he makes, in which case then we're also talking about someone who not only in terms of their character is evil, for lack of a better word, but also is crazy and disconnected from reality because he has delusional thinking. This is absolutely, on a scale of 1 to 100, this is 100 in terms of danger to the public. It would be impossible to construct a leader, if I had a free choice, if I could create a Frankenstein monster of every symptom in the DSM and wanted to put together the most destructive and dangerous leader possible, I could not improve on Donald Trump. This is a worst case scenario.
Would you review the protocol or evaluation you and your colleagues followed in order to arrive at this diagnosis? And then please provide examples from Trump's behavior and actions and speeches that give us clear evidence of this, what you would consider mental disturbance. And does this include a pathological sadistic tendency? You just mentioned that bullying, but bullying does not always rise to the level of pathological sadistic tendency. So try to differentiate the two.
Well, so sadism is taking pleasure in the pain of others. In other words, not just standing up for yourself, it's actually enjoying their pain. And so even before he was a political figure, he would taunt people and bully them and humiliate them. You know, this whole thing with Rosie O'Donnell. He gets pleasure from denigrating other people. Sadism has two components. One is harming other people, but the other is taking pleasure from it. He clearly evidences both. But just to get back to the larger question I think you were asking about, you know, where does this come from, I think there's been a misunderstanding about how the diagnostic process works. This feeling that somehow we're diagnosing Trump from a distance, I'm putting that in air quotes, and therefore it's a sort of wild, irresponsible, kind of half-baked conclusion, irresponsible sort of libelous conclusion. What a lot of people don't realize is that the field of psychiatry had a revolution in 1980 when we adopted the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And the revolution of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual was that for the first time we adopted clear, observable behavioral criteria for every disorder that we treat to increase some reliability and validity in our diagnosis. Because they are clear, observable behaviors, then it makes the diagnostic process much easier. So just to pick antisocial personality, for example, to start, because I did a bunch of diagnoses and I know we're limited in time. The criteria, the diagnostic criteria, the overarching criteria is a pervasive pattern of violating and exploiting the rights of others. Well, do we have enough evidence that he does that? Well, first of all, there's Trump University, where the Attorney General of New York, Eric Schneiderman, called it classic fraud. So if you're committing fraud and trying to basically steal or take away money from people on fraudulent terms, that's violating the rights of others. He does not pay his workmen. There's dozens of lawsuits that show that he doesn't pay his workmen, that it's a business practice for him. He makes them sue him for the balance of their money. That's violating the rights of others. And then finally, there's sexual assault. He's bragged about sexually assaulting women and his ability to do it. And at least a dozen women have come forward and said he sexually assaulted them, which, of course, probably makes us suspect there are more who haven't come forward. But I would say that there's really no one who can argue that sexual assault is not violating another person's rights. So if you're routinely sexually assaulting people, then I think we can say it's a pervasive practice that you violate people's rights. Lying is one of the main diagnostic criteria for antisocial. Well, I don't need to just say that I'm observing that he's lying. It is now a fact, not an alternative fact, a fact that he lies. PolitiFact, an objective group of journalists who fact-check all politicians, have said that 78% of his statements are lies, way higher than any other politician ever measured. Politico actually measured that he lies every 3 minutes and 15 seconds. So do I need to do a personal interview with Donald Trump and have him lie to my face to know he's a liar? Well, actually, he does lie to my face because I watch TV every night. We have public statements that are untrue, that he knows are untrue, that he has made in front of the entire world and verbally in his tweets. So we know that he lies. And not showing remorse for people you've harmed. Has anyone ever heard Donald Trump say he was sorry? I mean, even Frank Luntz once asked him if he ever asked God for forgiveness. And he said, no, why would I need to? So he doesn't even think he's ever done anything wrong, that he would ever even in his life need to ask God for forgiveness. And yet somehow the evangelical Christians voted for this guy. I don't quite get it. So it's very objective, really beyond any reasonable doubt, that he meets these behavioral criteria.
I appreciate your overview. Thank you. What I'd like to impress upon our listeners right now is that Trump at this moment is becoming increasingly more aggressive towards other nations. We've already witnessed undue military actions against Assad's Syrian forces. There has been escalation of bombing in Yemen. And by the way, by every international standard, every relief agency has said that Yemen is one of the most challenging places on earth right now, if you're a person living there, because there's upwards of 16 million people facing famine and facing starvation. Babies are dying because the infrastructures have been destroyed by Saudi Arabia. But the United States supports Saudi Arabia, and we are selling them the planes, the bomb, the cluster bombs, and other things that have been banned. Now, Trump has to know this. As functionally as literate as he may seem to be, he is surrounded by people, policy wonks, who have enough grasp of the reality on the ground that he must be getting something other than they're the enemy, it's black and white, go kill them. And so when I see someone who is not at all connected with any error, like in Yemen, there was a mistake and a whole bunch of innocent people were killed, and yet there was no apology. We had a casualty. Our one casualty is what all the energy was focused upon, but not the casualties of innocent people, as if they have no value. That concerns me. And also, we witnessed the release of the MOAB missile, the mother of all bombs, they said, against militants in Afghanistan. Now we're witnessing hyperactive reactions against North Korea and China and in the South China Seas, and very likely Russia with NATO in the future. So with a commander-in-chief this unstable and prone to violent reaction rather than reserve reflection, how dangerous do these potential scenarios of military conflict become?
Well, that's what I was saying. I mean, we're really at DEFCON 5. On a scale of 1 to 100, it's 100. I think you've put it very well. I would agree with everything you've said. And this is why we are speaking up. The reason we're called duty to warn is we feel that there's a danger we have to warn about. And you've just put your finger on the danger. The combination of being belligerent and paranoid and impulsive makes someone basically prone to impulsively starting a war that could kill millions of people. You mentioned the strike in Syria. You know, I've heard reasonable arguments both ways for whether we should have retaliated for the gas attack. But what you should pay attention to is the process whereby the decision was made. That only 3 days previous, his position, as expressed by Rex Tillerson, was that we would not try to oppose or remove Assad, that that should be left up to the Syrian people. Then there's a gas attack, and allegedly Ivanka showed him pictures and was crying. And then he marches into the Rose Garden and says, now that I've seen these pictures, my feelings about Syria has completely changed. And within 24 hours, missiles were being launched. So to go from to change your longstanding policy, whether it's right or wrong, in 3 days, impulsively, to go from military a policy to reversing your policy to military action in 3 days. I mean, to put this in context, George Bush took a month after the 9/11 attack before the first military activity, because there was a lot of planning and negotiating and strategizing and talking to our allies and coming up with a long-term plan. I mean, there's things that need to be done in a planful way. Certainly, George Bush was not a man of contemplation. He was a man of action. But that's different than being an irritable, impulsive man of action. And that's why our organization, we have circulated a petition among mental health professionals. And 50,000 of them now have signed our petition saying that we believe that Donald Trump is dangerously mentally ill and needs to be removed under the 25th Amendment. It has nothing to do with disagreeing with his politics. It has everything to do with the factors you're talking about, which is this kind of truculence and impulsivity and irritability that, you know, that New Yorker cartoon where he's sitting in the Oval Office and on his desk there's two red buttons, one says tweet, one says nuke. That's actually a very revealing cartoon, because there really is the feeling, especially with Korea, we could get into a war where millions of people could be killed just because of Donald Trump's irritability and impulsivity and paranoia.
I would agree with that. I would also suggest that we as a nation stop this madness of reacting to everything and start to use diplomatic reason and detente before we make decisions, because we now know of how much influence the neocons, the people who have their own political, ideological, and financial and political agenda, have worked every administration and the media. Our program specializes, this hour specializes in bringing people forth who are credible to share their insights. So it's not just Donald Trump who's got the finger close to that button. It's a whole lot of people who profit if there's war. Now, who doesn't profit? Well, the South Korea doesn't profit. You're only 40 miles away from Seoul, and you have to be aware that no matter what interventions were done preemptively, there's going to be an awful lot of death and carnage among the South Korean people and the innocent North Korean people. We forget that the average person living in North Korea is a prisoner to these sociopaths. Also, the potential for Japan to be embroiled. And so I'm concerned not just with Trump. I'm concerned with the entire pathology of the Washington people behind the scenes. Now, it appears that the mental health and the psychological profession, well, at least from my perspective, are under a gag order to not influence public debate or policy based upon psychological assessments of public figures. In short, this is like saying that the psychological profession is fundamentally amoral. It can diagnose, but the buck stops there. Ethical responses or actions are not permitted. And I might personally compare that to capitalism, which ignores the ethical consequences due to profit and growth as it bulldozes ahead, such as with climate change. For example, at the recent gathering at Yale, where duty to warn was publicly displayed, there was opposition from the psychiatric profession, notably the American Psychiatric Association. Was this always the case in the mental health profession? And if not, when and how did it change?
Well, you made two very good points I want to pick up on. Just to pick up on the first one, one of the concerns about Trump in terms of the larger picture is he has hollowed out the State Department of all of the career diplomats who have expertise. This is one classic move that dictators make. They get rid of the intelligentsia within their own government. So the fact that they've fired all the top Russia experts in the State Department, and none of them have been replaced, and none of the positions under Tillerson have been filled, this is what allows a dictator to have free reign. Because there are no dissenting voices, there's no wise men, there's no experienced Russia experts who have served eight presidents who can say, look, this isn't partisan, but that you need to take this and this and this into consideration. Those voices are gone. So this is one of the concerns that you mentioned in terms of the systemic question of the government as a whole. He's dismantling all of the voices who could provide any rational or informed opposition to any impulse he might have. Now, to get back to what you're saying about the American Psychiatric Association, we have received intense opposition. And in fact, my partner who organized that conference at Yale Medical School has really gotten a lot of heat from her employers. The university, a spokesperson, had to come out and say that we didn't represent them. The school of psychiatry had to say that. We got angry response from the Republican Party in Connecticut. But the American Psychiatric Association, I believe, has taken an ethical position that I believe is unethical, because it is a gag order. It's a response to a lawsuit in 1964 where there were some libelous statements made about Barry Goldwater that were unfair. But without getting into the details of that, sometimes you try to correct one mistake and you end up making another mistake. So we didn't want to make that mistake again of sort of careless, casual talk about public figures. But instead, we're making the mistake that took place in Nazi Germany. You know, the psychiatrists and the doctors and the ministers in Nazi Germany said nothing when Adolf Hitler rose. And now we look upon that as the greatest moral cowardice imaginable. And yet we're actually repeating the same thing right here, which is by putting a gag order on the people who are most qualified to comment on Donald Trump's blatant mental illness, is therefore basically silencing the voice that could say it with some authority. It's one thing for columnists to say it or journalists to say it, but they always have to say with an asterisk, but of course I'm no psychologist, what do I know? So the people who have no authority can say what they want, but they have no authority, and the people who have authority can't say anything because they're gagged. And so it leaves this kind of who knows what reality is or what truth is. Who knows if he's really crazy or not really crazy, if he's personality disordered or not personality disordered. And in that vacuum, it allows the dictator to rise. So we really have created a situation where I believe the American Psychiatric Association, and they've said this explicitly, their job is to protect the psychiatric profession, not the public. And I think they've thrown the public under the bus just to keep themselves from getting into trouble.
Most of us understand that in order to remove a president, aside from congressional impeachment, it must come from the vice president, in this case, Mike Pence. Is there any means or provision recognized by the Constitution in which a president could be removed due to severe incompetence or for posing a serious threat to the nation? And is there any loophole which might be used to enforce Trump to undergo psychiatric evaluation? Because as I understand the Goldwater rule that you mentioned earlier of 1973, a legitimate charge of mental incompetence or the presence of serious mental disorder is not valid unless a president or politician undergoes an actual face-to-face evaluation.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. According to the 25th Amendment, the president can be removed by the vice president and his cabinet if he's in some way incapacitated. It doesn't specify whether that incapacitation would be physical or psychiatric. I think when they wrote up the rule, they weren't even thinking about psychiatric. But Representative Earl Blumenauer of Oregon has recognized that we have no procedure for applying the 25th Amendment should a president become mentally ill, not even just about Trump in particular, but obviously it's Trump that's stimulating the interest in this law. Representative Blumenauer has introduced a resolution into Congress that would specify what the procedure would be if we suspected that a president needed to be removed under the 25th Amendment for psychiatric reasons. What he's proposed is that there be a panel of four psychiatrists, four physicians, and two or three senior statesmen, such as former presidents or former vice presidents of both parties, to create a, so yes, he would be examined, but also there would be a kind of a panel of that was nonpartisan or had both parties that would evaluate him. So our organization is very much in favor of this rule because we recognize there is a gap here, and so we are going to be lobbying our congressman to get this law adopted. We're also going to be having a march on Washington. You've heard of the March for Science. We're going to have a march for sanity. And we're going to have it in multiple cities, as these other marches have been. And we're going to be marching for two things. One, to stop the normalization of the abnormal, what Robert J. Lifton has called malignant normality, when a sick dictatorial leader takes control of society and starts to shift the perception of reality, as happened in Hitler's Germany. So before Hitler's Germany, yeah, people were anti-Semitic, but there wasn't mass killing of Jews. Once Hitler took over and shifted the reality of the society, that became the new normal. So we're trying to fight that malignant new normal. And secondly, we're marching in favor of this bill, which we would like to see passed because of just the gap that you mentioned.
Okay. I have some other questions that relate more to the two-party electorate rather than Trump himself, because when you look back at Bill Clinton, who has also been charged with serial sexual misconduct, but mainly it was a single affair with Monica Lewinsky, why is it that the general psychology of liberals is more apologetic and prefers to ignore or deny the significance of a liberal leader and questionable moral behavior? You can look at JFK and Lyndon Johnson as other presidents whose sexual lives were perhaps even worse than Clinton's. Then the same holds true for conservative Republicans who would come out more in moralistic terms. They profess uncompromising allegiance to their Christian beliefs, but then turn right around and advocate bombing and inhumane torture and collateral damage of the death of women and children and even support of death squads, as we've seen in recent WikiLeaks revelations, both in Central America, South America, and in Yugoslavia and other places. So from the standpoint of the psychological profession, or you personally, how do liberals and conservatives manage to justify these odd behaviors?
Right. Well, you know, some people have argued that, you know, what we're saying stigmatizes mentally ill because the vast majority of people with some sort of mental illness or psychiatric condition are more than capable of doing their jobs. So we're not saying that all people with mental illness are incapable of doing their jobs. We're saying that there's some severe forms of mental illness that have made this president incapable of doing his job. But I am an equal opportunity Goldwater violator. I wrote a book. I wrote a biography of Bill Clinton. Called In Search of Bill Clinton, a psychological biography, in which I argue that he has hypomania, which, by the way, I did not invent. I meant to correct that also. I am maybe one of the people that's written more about it in the current day, but the term has been around for 100 years. I focused on something that I have called hypomanic temperament. It's a subclinical form of hypomania that isn't actually a psychiatric disorder, but it has, to a milder extent, all of the symptoms of mania. So the energy, the charisma, the risk tolerance, the creativity, the aggressiveness, the ambition, the drive, but also the impulsivity, the irritability, the poor judgment, all of those things. So it's a mixed bag. It actually combines a lot of very positive traits, the kind of entrepreneurial traits that we see in most entrepreneurs have this temperament, but also some downsides in terms of being impulsive, arrogant, or showing poor judgment. And quite often, the expression of that impulsivity can be in the area of sexual misbehavior. It can be in other areas, too. Bill Clinton also had discontrol of his impulses in other areas. He had a lot of temper tantrums. People didn't know about that, although more recently it came out in the campaign with Hillary when he was caught on tape arguing with a reporter. But really it was a secret within the White House how much he could lose his temper. He had discontrol of his eating. His constantly weight was going up and down because he was such a huge compulsive eater. But that said, there's a difference between having some mental issues or being, on, in his case, somewhere on the bipolar spectrum, and this kind of catastrophic worst-case scenario I'm talking about in Trump. That what we're talking about here really is the Hitler personality disorder and a complete detachment from reality, not, you know, being a little too impulsive and having poor judgment and sometimes being a little reckless or arrogant. In other words, these, they're matters of degree. And I think you can argue that looking at the peace and prosperity, the result of that Clinton's presidency was pretty good in terms of its outcome, even if he wasn't a perfect person. But here, but he actually had a lot of traits that Trump doesn't have. For one thing, he was an incredible policy wonk. He knew everything about everything. I mean, even when they did the federal budget, I interviewed the people who worked on his economic team, said they'd never seen anything like it. He read the entire federal budget. The federal budget is like five phone books, and had meetings going to 3 a.m. because he was asking obscure questions about various aspects of the budget. But he mastered it. And he mastered it to the point where, you know, people were saying, well, we could fudge this, we could fudge that, and make it look like the budget balance. I will not lie about the budget. We have to make it actually balanced, and yet it also has to benefit working people. So he managed to do something that's quite unusual. He balanced the budget while increasing help to the lowest income-earning Americans. He added something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is a negative income tax. It actually puts money in the pockets of the working poor. And so with the signing of that one budget, he raised 20 million people out of the poverty line, and at the same time balanced the budget, not in fake numbers, in real numbers. So despite his flaws, he was able to apply his brilliance and his energy to solving a major social problem. Obviously, all of these traits are lacking in Trump. He has no interest in policy. He doesn't even have enough attention span to read. He gets all his news from cable TV. He has really no honest concern about the poor and the effects his policies will have on them. He was told, don't you realize it's your voters who are going to disproportionately lose their health insurance under this plan? He said, yeah, I know that. So he neither cares about people or about policy and doesn't have the attention span to really pay attention to either. So not all mental illnesses are created equal. I don't think this is a double standard. I think this is an honest assessment of the psychiatric strengths and weaknesses of these different leaders.
I appreciate those insights. I would hold a different opinion on some aspects of Clinton, the Clintons, since they co-president ruled, that I also saw when Madeleine Albright on 60 Minutes was questioned by Leslie Stahl, that the sanctions the Clintons had been following had caused massive harm to the children and the poor in Iraq. 500,000 minimally died. It later turned out to be over 647,000. And was it acceptable? And she said yes. She was there as a spokesperson, both as Secretary of State and UN ambassador. So that showed me an insensitivity. I also saw that he took away 1.5 million welfare people's capacity to be on welfare, and that caused massive harm when you consider it's about four persons per family. So that's over 6 million people. And also it was the three strikes and you're out he created, and also the largest increase in incarceration in American history, and also doubling down on the war on drugs and making it easier for people with small amounts of marijuana to serve up to 7 years in prison. So, and his environmental track record was equally horrendous. So where the things you're suggesting, I would basically agree with on some. I would share, let's say, a more Paris-ed view on other aspects of Clinton. But that's aside. That's completely aside from the issue at hand. During the campaign, there were many attacks and criticisms about Hillary's honesty as well, such as her personality her being extreme, and the multiple people, you mentioned Bill's temper, but Secret Service agents, four of them, went on the record talking about what it was like working for her. And these were people who are now retired, so they were no longer bound by that oath. and what she was like. And they actually thought Bill Clinton was nice and easygoing and pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Hillary
yeah,
was the mean-spirited one there.
Yeah.
But also she has a propensity to flip-flop. And I wanted to see how many times she flip-flopped. And I had over 30 flip-flops. We're not talking about little ones. Even her physical health and mental state, where she should have just come forward and said, here's the issue and here's how I'm dealing with it. It was always filtered. So we never knew how much was true and how much was being hidden. So here's my problem with her reappearance, because now she's reappeared. A recent ABC Washington Post poll shows the Democrats are more out of touch today with the direction of the nation than they were in 2014. 67% of those polled, I'm talking about Democrats, also feel that they're out of touch, the Democratic Party is. And almost 100 days in, Trump continues to hold, a 96% approval among his core supporters. And if a Clinton-Trump rerun of the election were held today, Trump would win by a larger margin. 11% who voted for Clinton in November said they would not vote for her today. So what is this telling us about not the candidates, but overall the condition of the American electorate? And what is it about Trump that sustains his popularity among his supporters because only 2% in the poll stated they would regret their vote? How do you account for this? And how does the leader who is unable to be truthful, speaks in grandiose words that put more attention upon himself rather than the rest of the nation, and who clearly displays a violent temperament, misogynist temperament, managed to hold sway to his supporters?
Yeah, it's a bedeviling question that you certainly hear everywhere. My understanding as a psychologist is that I think this goes back to very, very deep programming within our brain, actually pre-human programming, that relates to the way primates relate to within groups and out groups. That it goes back to chimpanzees. Chimpanzees actually have wars where the alpha male will get the other alpha males excited, and they will go to the edge of the territory and systematically beat up and kill the males of the other troop and then take over their territory and their women. So this is something, war goes back that far. And so the natural tendency is to follow the alpha male of your group, because that alpha male is going to be the one who will lead you into battle, which will either allow you to expand your territory or will cause you to be wiped out. So it's life and death. And whether that alpha male is flawed is really irrelevant. The life and death of your entire community is based on the leadership of that aggressive martial leader. And what Donald Trump brilliantly did is he divided America so that instead of being us, the American people, perhaps against the Russians or whoever else might want to destroy us or wish us harm, he went beyond the dog whistle and overtly gave a signal to white Americans and said, we the people, meaning we the white Americans, are a tribe. We share a genetic connection. And the brown people and the people who are not part of our white tribe are our enemies, and we need to unite against them. And so he became the alpha male of the white tribe against the non-white tribe. And everything is forgiven in those circumstances, because you've got to galvanize behind your powerful alpha male leader. So it's essentially a second civil war that he has started. And it worked to bring him into power, but it is incredibly destructive for our nation. And now it's gotten to the point where his voters are calling his collusion with Russia an unimaginable act of a traitor, something that if you saw it in a, Ludlum novel or, a spy novel, that the president was actually working in coordination with Russia and that his people were Russian agents or talking to Russian agents or making deals with Russian agents, you would put the book down and you'd say, oh, come on, that could never happen. I can't even finish this book as fiction. It's so unrealistic. And yet the evidence is pouring out that that's exactly what happened, and his supporters are dismissing it as fake news. So even treason is not enough to pull them away from him, because they would rather be in league with Russia against the brown Americans or the liberal Americans then to unite as a nation against our common enemies. And this will be the end. Mark my words. This is the end of the American empire. It's the end of the American century. If we have factions within our own government who are aligning with foreign hostile powers against other Americans just to gain power, then we're a house divided, and we will fall, as Abraham Lincoln warned.
I have a final question, and you can break it into several parts, because it has been my personal feeling that throughout history, people who had the right message at the right time were not able to really connect, and other people felt threatened by their message. Could have been the industries threatened that they would be adversely affected. Think of Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Desmond Tutu. Even today, Jill Stein or Ralph Nader. They could never get elected because of their high ethical stance. So on the one hand, they can't get 1% of the vote in most cases. And yet here was Hillary. Now separate off Bill for a moment. Very charismatic, easy to get along with, likable guy. A mixture of policies, both constructive and destructive. But with Hillary, there's no mixed here. If you take a look, she promotes herself in the Democratic Party, promotes itself as for the workers, yet it has undermined labor unions. Look at NAFTA and GATT and the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the TTIP that she strongly supported. And WikiLeaks shows she went to 44 different countries to speak with their presidents or prime ministers about supporting it, yet she said that she had made up her mind. Also, she promoted herself as the peace candidate, and yet she was a staunch war hawk. Look at her actions in Honduras, Libya, Syria, the campaign against the Ukraine, the coup in Yugoslavia, in Venezuela and Yugoslavia, and her alignment, all of her speeches, all the money she made speaking on Wall Street, and then speaking before the war industry corporations, and her strong support of Saudi Arabia. And yet she said she was for women's rights. Well, unless I guess they're from 16 different Arab nations that did not support women's rights as we know them. So she could almost get elected or could get elected. And yet people who are on the right side of all things ethical, moral, and judgmental, who are real scholars of what they do, I mean, Desmond Tutu and Jill Stein. You know, Jill Stein, in my opinion, is the template of what an empowered female leader should be, and Ralph Nader the same. So how is it that we can have one group never get elected, mocked and ridiculed, derided and scorned, and another group praised without any sense of irony as to what they're actually getting when they get that person? Your final thoughts, please.
Well, look, I think history will look back on this election as a perfect storm. I mean, this is the biggest electoral catastrophe in American history. And the weakness of Hillary Clinton as a candidate was one of the factors. I mean, I could disagree, or we could quibble, or we could have a whole, you know, show basically doing a postmortem on a number of the issues you raised. They're very complex. But just to leave it to say that she wasn't a perfect candidate by any means. She had flaws. That was part of what opened the door for someone who is truly a human monster. He's a monster. And I'm not saying that to be dramatic. Eric Frome called malignant narcissism the quintessence of evil. So because in part of Hillary's weaknesses and Russian hacking and fake news and James Comey's surprise announcement and the Republicans' faux investigation of Benghazi and email, just like they had a faux investigation of Whitewater, and the animosity of the, you know, that was whipped up among the white electorate, and Donald Trump's kind of con man persona, all of these factors together, and a corrupt Republican Party who enables his bad doings, all of these factors together created a catastrophic result. So was Hillary perfect? Far from it. Is the person who is in charge now out of control? Yes, he is.
Well, that I absolutely agree with you. And I believe that anyone else in office, even the most flawed, would at least have a dialogue with the American public where there was an opportunity for all sides to be presented. And that's not the case here. You're not going to have but one opinion, and that's Donald Trump's, right, or those who have his ear. Yeah. And when you got Steve Bannon and you got Mad Dog Mattis and some of these other people, and Mattis was the person who led the absolute genocide and broke crimes against the Geneva Convention in Iraq, I believe that we are in trouble. I believe we're in serious trouble. And I believe that the media, the media that supports Trump, or the media that is not angry at Trump, they're angry that Hillary Clinton lost and are not focused on real issues. And be very specific, if you're in the media, tell us what you are opposed to, but then tell us what you're supportive of. And I believe that we better understand who's in power.
Yeah, most people I know are more upset that Trump won than that Hillary lost. And to be honest, I'd be relieved with a President Pence, even though I disagree with everything he stands for. But as I always tell people, he's conservative. He's not crazy. He's not going to start a war with North Korea. So that's our dilemma. It's not about politics. It's about psychopathology.
Yeah. It is something for us to all contemplate. It is a legitimate discussion. And I'm glad that you're out there with the other, what did you say, 50,000 supporters?
Duty to warn. Yes, 50,000 people have signed our petition. 50,000 mental health professionals who have signed our petition for duty to warn, yes.
And the website is John Gartner, GARTNER.com?
Well, that's my personal website. We have a Facebook group. If people want to join our Facebook group, that's probably the easiest way to be in communication with us. And the Facebook group is also called Duty to Warn.
Okay. Thank you very much, John, for being on today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a break and come right back. I'm Gary Nall. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. In closing comments, I wanted to share my own insights. I chose to allow the doctor to share his point of view. Normally, I would offer some challenges, but if I did, then the whole effort would be on he and I differing on the legitimacy of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which I consider nothing more than a comic book where there's no science whatsoever. Everything is just an opinion. However, I do support the idea that patterns of behavior in people can be very descriptive of their true nature, irrespective of what they are putting on as far as the nice face to the public. So it would seem that all the previous presidents, save perhaps Eisenhower and Carter, had some degree of narcissistic personality disorder, although this would not be diagnosed as statistically dangerous. All the presidents from Reagan through Obama possessed extreme charm. Reagan had that Hollywood charisma that came out with his quick improvisational wit and humor. Daddy Bush had his paternal quality and Texas gentlemanly stature. Bill Clinton, with his physical charisma and his hipness and equally quick wit, as well as his unquestionably high IQ, once ranked fourth among all historical presidents. Baby Bush, for his down-home Southern charm and religious morals, characterized well by Machiavelli in his political novel, The Prince, the kind of guy you'd want to sit at a bar stool with, and Obama for his equally sharp wit, his athleticism, his informal mannerisms, and a certain lightheartedness towards criticism. And they all smiled a lot. What each also possessed is that critical lacking quality in Trump, and that is, they could handle criticism, he can't. His inability to deal with self-critical or outside critical comments. He cannot accept mistakes. He never says he's sorry. He can't laugh at himself. This is all foreign to Trump. Trump truly never displays a sense of humor in any fashion. What humor he shows is only framed in ridicule and nasty slurs. But now here is my posit. I believe that Reagan and Bush Sr. and Bush Jr., Obama and Clinton, both Clintons, all had something in common. And underlying all that charm, they also had the construct for a sociopathology, a sociopathic tendencies. That's by what they did and supported. Example, perhaps the one president during the past 35 years who may have been the most psychologically sound was actually Ronald Reagan, since he did not launch outright immoral wars, but did support confrontations that were more aligned with the time of the Cold War and remnants of McCarthyism and the fear of Soviet Union and communism. But some of his questionable actions that could be associated with abnormal mental behavior would be the scandals of Iran-Contra, the U.S. federal cocaine smuggling with the CIA involved, supporting the first modern wave of Islamic militancy and terrorism in the Soviet-Afghan conflict, serving as a spy for the FBI in Hollywood during McCarthy's Red Scare, supporting South African apartheid and not supporting Mandela, and support for regressive regimes and death squads in Central America, notably in Nicaragua and El Salvador. Daddy Bush, well, he showed really bad judgment and bad behavior, deploying weapons such as depleted uranium and cluster bombs in the first war in Iraq that actually was in Kuwait, and the extermination of thousands of Iraqi soldiers fleeing Kuwait to return to Iraq. It was Bush, along with Intel, that cut deals with the Ayatollah in October for the October surprise to get Reagan into office, and years of dealing privately and at the federal level with repressive regimes, including Saudi Arabia and the bin Laden family and the Eastern Bloc fascist expats, especially Ukraine and Saddam Hussein. Also attempts to shut down investigations into savings and loan scandals and the BCCI money laundering scandal. Now, the Clintons, well, at the top of the list are the serial sexual offenses, including allegations from credible sources of rape on multiple women, and the rise of the private prison system and gutting of prisoner rights, three strikes and you're out, racism behind his version of the war on drugs, in private life, a parasite upon developing nations. Everything that the Clintons touched, they exploited, always for the worse for that country. Haiti is a good example. Favoritism for Wall Street over Main Street, international trade agreements such as the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act and the promotion of GATT and NAFTA in the World Trade Organizations, sanctions against Iraq that led to 500,000 children dying, the Balkan Wars, Yugoslavia and Serbia and Kosovo, which were unnecessary, Rwanda and the Hutu massacre of 800,000 Tutsis, 1993 military coup in Haiti, the bombing of the Sudan pharmaceutical plant. And then you have Baby Bush, clearly a war criminal with his invasion of Iraq based upon solid evidence of lies and corruption, huge civilian deaths in Afghanistan and Iraq, torture and black site operations, breakdown of constitutional rights to set up a police state, 9/11, depending upon your interpretation of events, either knowing it and not preventing it, or covering up what actually happened, and the start of our military drone policies. And then you had Obama, the ultimate Mr. Charming, broke many, if not most, campaign promises. Were these simply lies? Such as universal health care he was going to get, he didn't. Support public schooling, he didn't. Tackle the prison problem, he didn't. Anti-Wall Street stance, he wasn't. And the assassination of American citizens via executive order. Regime changes in Ukraine, Honduras, Paraguay, Libya, and the start of attempts in Syria and Yemen. Expansion of the drone programs in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. The repression of civil rights to his creation of surveillance state and unregulated spying. So those also should be taken into account. When we do, and we look beyond whether we like someone, whether they are charming, the fact is we must judge people, irrespective of our political affiliation, by what they do. What is their actual legacy? And with each one of the people I just mentioned, I could take you around the world and I could show you the results. And then you say, wow, I like the guy. The media covered them very favorably, like Clinton and especially Obama and Reagan. But I didn't know they did all these bad things. Well, how can a normal, healthy mind engage in such pathology? I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening to this special edition of the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day. Hey, what's up now? Brother, what's up?
cry. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you die. You know we